Hello everyone, my name is Ziad Kazi. I'm an emergency physician, associate professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Emory University. I'm also a board member of the American College of Medical Toxicology and the president of the Middle East North Africa Clinical Toxicology Association. I'm bringing you today a summary of our recent webinar that was organized by the American College of Medical Toxicology, the Middle East North Africa Clinical Toxicology Association, and the European Association of Poison Control Centers and Clinical Toxicologists. The webinar was titled Medical and Public Health Considerations of Chloroquine and Hydroxychloroquine Use During the COVID-19 Pandemic. A full recording of the webinar is available at www.acmt.net. However, it was requested from me to provide a brief summary of the discussions that were provided during this one-hour session that was held on March 25th, 2020. This webinar, like I said, was moderated by the Executive Director of the ACMT, Dr. Paul Wax, and the panelists included Dr. Michelle Ruha, President of the American College of Medical Toxicology and Professor of Emergency Medicine at the University of Arizona College of Medicine in Phoenix, Arizona, as well as Dr. Bruno Migarban, who's a board member of MINATOX, a past president of the EAPCCT, and a professor of critical care medicine and head of department of medical and toxicological critical care at Labrazier Hospital in Paris, France. None of our speakers and panelists had any conflicts of interest to disclose. And we wanted to accomplish three objectives during this webinar, which were to summarize anecdotal evidence related to the use of chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine in COVID-19 infections, as well as describe adverse effects related to the therapeutic use of these agents, as well as the acute overdose situation. Dr. Wax started by providing an overview of the current pandemic, including the number of cases, the epidemiological curves, as well as the case fatality rates that we are seeing around the world and in the United States of America. He also provided a brief description of the SARS-CoV-2 2019 virus and the potential mechanisms whereby the drugs, chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine, can be effective in this infection. He shared some of the current evidence supporting this, which is primarily relying on in vitro studies, the experience with the SARS epidemic in 2003, as well as several expert opinions and 23 ongoing clinical trials in China. These trials, unfortunately, do not have any published results yet. There are also other trials that are being undertaken all around the world, including the United States, where we have started to see some hospitals recommend the use of hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine for COVID-19 infections in the U.S. However, of course, these guidelines are still off-label, and they are restricted primarily to a specific category of patients with significant disease and severity. Dr. Wax also discussed briefly the history of use of chloroquine, a derivative of quinine used for malaria, and its cousin, hydroxychloroquine, which was synthesized in 1946 and is supposedly better tolerated than chloroquine, also used for malaria, specifically in areas where chloroquine resistance is absent. Hydroxychloroquine is also used for lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. The mechanisms summarized by Dr. Wax regarding the use of hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine for COVID-19 primarily focus on the ability of these drugs to interfere with the function of the virus in its replication and ability to infect cells, as well as potential immunomodulatory effects that may be useful in the cytokine storms that are seen in the COVID-19 patients. At that point, Dr. Bruno Migarban interjected and discussed his current experience in his intensive care unit in Paris. He described a study that was published by Dr. Didier Raoul in the Journal of Antimicrobial Agents. This was an open-label, non-randomized clinical trial where patients received hydroxychloroquine versus hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin versus controls. And in this study, he found benefit in the amount of viral shedding that was measured in these patients that was significantly obvious between days 3 and day 6 of treatment. This has led several French physicians and ICU doctors to start using this regimen in their patients. Again, this is of course still not fully approved to be used in France, but it's currently being used by Dr. Megarban, who currently has 15 patients receiving this therapy. He described that this therapy has not proven to be miraculous. However, it's really hard for him to draw any conclusions because of the small size of his sample of patients that are being treated, as well as the lack of controls that are not receiving this therapy to compare with. He did comment on this therapy being monitored using monitoring of the QT interval. And he did mention that he had to have 3 patients withdraw from the study because they had prolongation of the QT interval with the QTC greater than 500 milliseconds. Now, at that point, I interjected and discussed why did we decide to do this webinar so rapidly. And this is because we saw some reports in Nigeria of individuals being poisoned with chloroquine. And then we also discussed the recent incident in Arizona where Dr. Michelle Ruha described her care for 2 patients that ingested chloroquine phosphate that they had at their home after hearing of the use of these drugs for COVID-19. This couple used this aquarium disinfectant that they owned that was made of chloroquine phosphate with the hope of preventing a COVID-19 infection. They became severely ill, and the husband actually died shortly after arrival to the hospital. The wife had several episodes of vomiting and was admitted to the intensive care unit, and I believe she is recovering currently. These incidents really made ACMT, MENATOX, and EAPCCT work together rapidly to get some information to the public about the hazards of these non-pharmaceutical compounds, as well the potential hazards of the pharmaceutical formulations of hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine when not used as prescribed or properly. Because as we all know, these drugs are have relatively narrow therapeutic index. And of course, the toxicity that can occur in patients is going to depend on the dose used, the duration of the therapy, the concomitant therapies that patients are already receiving or they may already be on, and individual patient characteristics. For example, if somebody has renal failure with a low GFR, if someone has liver failure, even genetic variability in our ability to metabolize these drugs through the cytochrome P450 would be an important determinant of toxicity. Now, in acute overdose, toxicologists are very familiar with these drugs and really focus on 3 areas in the pathophysiology of the acute toxicity from these agents. Specifically, the sodium channel blockade that can occur from chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, the potassium channel blockade, as well as the shift of potassium intracellularly, which leads to severe hypokalemia. And then we then discussed the adverse effects from these therapies, whether they are used therapeutically, in a supra-therapeutic fashion, as well as an acute overdose. And we discussed how they have effects on a variety of organ systems, primarily the cardiovascular system, the conduction in the heart, with the effect on the QRS interval and the QTC interval. We discussed its effect on the central nervous system with the possibility of neuropsychiatric abnormalities, seizures, and coma. Of course, these drugs affect the gastrointestinal system with nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain. They can affect muscles and cause myopathy. They can cause cardiomyopathy. They can cause neuropathy, sensory neural hearing loss, and visual problems. The problems in vision are subtle initially and can be missed. Eventually, they can progress to develop the bullseye maculopathy. Unfortunately, this is a late finding and these visual problems can persist despite stopping the drug. Considering these broad range of symptoms, we recommended that clinicians stay alert to these effects, even in therapeutic, supratherapeutic, and certainly in overdose situations. In the last part of the webinar, we discussed two aspects. One is the management of the acute overdose situation, as well as the public health implications of these drugs being used during this pandemic. Regarding the acute overdose management, we discussed the importance of assessing the risk from the ingestion and aggressive supportive care that may include gastric emptying or gastric decontamination, depending on the specific scenario. We also discussed the importance of early intubation and mechanical ventilation and the use of high-dose epinephrine, the dose recommended in the Goldfrank's textbook of medical toxicology is 0.25 micrograms per kilogram per minute as an infusion that could be titrated up to maintain the blood pressure at a satisfactory level. It also includes the use of high-dose diazepam infusion, specifically a 2 milligram per kilogram bolus over 30 minutes, followed by a 1 to 2 milligram per kilogram per 24 hours infusion for 2 to 3 days until the patient improves. We then discussed the management of the hypokalemia that usually occurs. These patients develop hypokalemia that can be severe. And as I mentioned before, it is from the transcellular shift of potassium inside the cell. So if you go ahead and replete the potassium early on, you may end up in a hyperkalemic state. So you really have to be careful and replete the potassium, specifically when you feel that this hypokalemia is going to cause prolongation of the QT interval and arrhythmias. Finally, we discussed the role of bicarbonate. As we know, sodium bicarbonate is usually used for white QRS. And if you see white QRS in these patients, like we mentioned earlier from the sodium channel blockade, you are going to want to maybe potentially use sodium bicarb. However, sodium bicarb can also lower the potassium levels by shifting it intercellularly. So it's important to weigh the pros and cons of using sodium bicarbonate therapy in these situations. We discussed that there was no benefit from extracorporeal removal, such as dialysis, and also mentioned that there's no good evidence supporting the use of intralipid therapy for these situations, although there are some case reports. We finished up by discussing the public health implications or considerations when using chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine during the COVID-19 pandemic. We realized that there are no clinical guidelines that are available to guide this therapy in the inpatient or even in the outpatient setting, and what type of monitoring would need to be followed, especially if these drugs end up being used at a population level for a large number of people and not as they are right now under clinical trials or off-label use in inpatient settings. We discussed the importance of clinical guidelines addressing the use of these drugs in vulnerable populations, which should include healthcare providers, including emergency responders. Also addressing the needs for children, pregnant women, and those that are breastfeeding. Finally, we discussed the importance of thinking through how we can provide these drugs if needed, knowing that there's a limited supply. Limited supply, and that will create shortage in those patients that use these medications for other indications such as lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, or malaria. And also the risk that the public that may be concerned about their own health and misinformed about the use of these drugs may go and seek alternative non-pharmaceutical products which may be hazardous to their health and occasionally lethal. Based on all of these considerations, we really hope that additional effort is dedicated to the public health aspects related to these two medications during this COVID-19 pandemic. We concluded the presentation with a question and answer session that was very, very interactive and enlightening. And currently the recording is available, like I said, at the acmt.net website under webinars. I hope you enjoy viewing the webinar at your leisure. Please feel free to email info@acmt.net and also tweet at ACMT, at MENATalks, at EAPCCT. My personal email is zkazzi@emory.edu, and my Twitter is @ziadkazi. Thank you for your attention.